question I like to ask people is, can you tell the story of your life where you take no credit for anything that happened? You've got to assign it to the things you were around you and the people that were around you and the opportunities that you were given, and take no credit for it yourself.
Whether it's the clothes you wear to work or a metaphor for putting up a front, we all wear a uniform. But often there's a lot going on behind the uniform, and many of us are reluctant to express how we are really feeling.
Each week on Behind the Uniform, Dr. Izzy Smith and Captain Hugo Tuvey will be joined by a special guest as they talk openly and honestly about their experiences with mental health. Nothing will be off limits, so prepare yourself for tears, laughter and goosebumps.
Welcome back to Behind the Uniform podcast. It's another beautiful day. It's a sunny day in Sydney. And Iz, we're back for another episode with a pretty amazing guest.
Yes, this is a guest I immediately thought of when we started throwing ideas around for season two. Our guest is, if you don't know him, Josh Reed Jones. He is the founder of the organization Just Be Nice, and he's been in the social enterprise area for over 15 years. And he said, ever since he's been young, he's been driven to ask, why are people not given the help they're needed? And he's trying to come up with a solution to this problem. Not only is Josh a guy that dedicates his life to helping others, he's also the best all-rounder I know. He was almost a professional football player. He's a drummer. He's got a degree in philosophy, marketing, and English literature. And on top of all of that, he's also a qualified chippy. So I said to Josh when we prepared for this podcast, I was like, mate, what can you not do? Because I also know that you're not a bad cook either.
Yeah, you did. You guessed it though. In one, you guessed that I'm not too handy with a pen or a pencil and drawing and art and all that sort of stuff. And certainly not sculpture or anything to do with clay. It would just be a massive mess. So there's
sorry, Josh. People have to be well qualified in sculpture to be on this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. I would have thought it would be an important prerequisite.
Gee, now, mate, Hugo, not a bad CV you got there. It's impressive. Yeah. And I must admit, having that whole Just Be Nice, you seem like a bloody legend of a bloke. I was frantically running late for this podcast and I was thinking, well, and we've stuffed you around previously. And I thought, well, it's almost a good test for you, mate. Because if there's any guest to have that probably doesn't let these things get to them, it's probably you, right, mate?
Yeah, that's right. I just write a nasty Google review afterwards. That's the, you know, anonymous Google review later on.
Yes, we are having a little bit of deja vu. We tried to record this episode and everything that could go wrong did go wrong. My dog chewed through my laptop cord. Then Hugo's internet was down. So the only person that wasn't having disasters was the guest, who graciously has said will come on again. So take two.
On that, Josh, I'm gonna, before we get into the depths of your background, your amazing story, to get a feel about our guest, we just want to ask you, what are you doing when you are at your happiest?
I am at my happiest when I'm relaxed, but being mildly productive. So doing things like, you know, getting out and about, running and hiking and out in the surf or reading and, you know, doing those things and probably eating good food and getting a bit happy on the old grape juice that I know Izzy's trying to avoid at the moment. But for me, yeah, those are the things that probably keep me my happiest.
And Josh, we know you always keep a notepad with you on all times and you like to record bits and pieces. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, until the March 2020, when we used to go around to places and go places, I was on the road quite a bit, either in Melbourne or interstate or internationally and whatever. And I sort of developed a habit years ago of always keeping like something to read on me and then notebooks with me as well. And I keep one sort of notebook where I keep, I don't know, my more sensible longevity type. I'll keep these notebooks for a while, thoughts, and I take notes from the books I'm reading. And then I have another like scribbly, you know, I'm catching up with Hugo and his 10:30 or 11 o'clock on a Saturday one, which is just full of, you know, doodles and little bits of notes. So yeah, I've been doing that for a long time, and I've got a million notebooks now, and I've been gifted quite a few as well because people sort of understand that I'm always carrying them. So I've got a little stockpile in my cupboard.
I love
here.
That, mate. And I was going to ask you. You said you got a stockpile, so you keep them all.
I keep my old ones that have got good stuff in them, and the old like, you know, catching up at 10:30 ones. I don't usually keep on hold on to them for too long, or maybe a little bit of time because you've got to go back and be like, I had a meeting maybe 12 months ago or something, and took some notes in that, and I'll check it out. But I keep the other ones, and I've got some empty ones ready to go. I think anyone who like is into stationery will resonate with just buying stationery when it's around, because
I think it's quite calming. I think nice. I buy stationery when I'm a bit stressed. Now, Josh, we're going to talk about your background in the podcast today. You do a lot of keynote speaking. You run Just Be Nice. You do a lot of training for workplaces in the social enterprise area. And you've also just been living through the longest pandemic of anywhere in the world. And you've been a real voice of reason, hope, and calm for a lot of people through this period. But before we go into all the amazing work you're doing and what we can learn from you, I think we need to learn a bit more about who Josh is. Can you tell us a bit about where you're from, you know, what life was growing up like for you, and also what you think it was that sparked this desire and need to help others and, as you say, help people when they need it? Because that's something that, you know, apart from healthcare, not many people can have a problem and just go and get it fixed.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing you've sort of said about this. I know that you're very kind and went and listened to some other stuff that I've done and read some things I've written, and you said, oh, you don't talk enough about yourself a little bit, so we're going to try and do that. So
yes, it was all about charities. Yeah. And I was like, can we talk a bit about you, Josh? You're the star.
I'm not great at it, but I guess from the start, you know, I was born.
That was a good start. You're really unique in that part.
That was pretty standard. As a doctor, I'm sure you understand how that all works. You
we're
know,
going way back, Josh. I like it.
Yeah, all the way back. We take it straight to the beginning.
I was conceived.
Yeah, I do have some inkling about that story also in my house. It's not
Let's keep it PG rated things, for the time being, guys. You're allowed to swear, but no sex.
So, yeah, I'm the eldest of three. I've got a younger sister and a younger brother, and my parents separated when I was maybe 10 or something like that. So, you know, when you've got a bit of a absent, kind of irresponsible father, it really felt like mum had been single mumming long before that happened as well. So we sort of had pretty significant financial struggles when I was a kid. We didn't really have much money or anything like that. And that was a struggle. And then my father had battled through his life with drug and alcohol addiction and mental illness, and we had fairly significant incidents of domestic violence, and in fact that was at the very end, that was the last thing that sort of prompted us to leave and then do that sort of pack your bags in the evening and run out of the house in your pajamas situation. And then it was just the four of us, and my man was around for a few years, and then he wasn't, and I sort of grew up, finished school, did an apprenticeship, went to uni at the same time, did a bunch of other stuff. And I guess, like you said, I've done a few things and still kicking on, trying to do more and get to chat to you lovely people.
Well, firstly, Josh, thank you for sharing that. It obviously sounds like you've had a very challenging upbringing, but testament to you, mate, because you just seem like a bloody great guy. And I guess being the eldest of three, you probably would have had to take on that sort of man of the house, that father figure in a way, and no doubt you've supported your mum over the years. But I just want to ask you, from that moment of you know, leaving in the middle of the night, you know, packing your bags, dressing your PJs, and the follow-on years, what's your relationship been like, or what was your relationship like with your dad over the next period of your life?
Yeah, so there was a sort of custody situation that was dragged on for a bit. He did move away, so he lived in Shepparton, and he moved back to Lakes Entrance at one point. And you know, so he'd come down and we'd see him. But I think also, while the custody fights were going on, that was sort of happening. He lived nearby for a while. He lived in a suburban caravan park, so we'd go and stay there. And I don't know if you've ever lived in a suburban caravan park, but it's, you know, not that exciting of a place, you know. But then eventually it just kind of drifted off. There's a thing that happens often, particularly in environments of domestic violence, where there's this kind of strange power dynamic where people will just make it difficult for a while. So while there was custody battles going on, he was sort of around doing things, not super consistent. He wasn't a super consistent kind of person, but, you know, he was around. And then sort of that drifted off as the responsibility got a bit more and it got a bit harder. He crashed a few cars being drunk driving and all that kind of stuff. So it got hard to come down, and then it got a bit irresponsible. And eventually, after he offered me drugs and some stuff, I decided I didn't want to see him anymore. And so I stayed home, and Eventually, a little bit after that, I think I started seeing him again, but then eventually just the contact sort of just drifted away. You know, you're supposed to see him once a month, and then that happens once every 3 months or four months, and then you stop hearing from him, and then that was kind of the deal. And when I was, I think, 18 or 19, I wrote him a letter and said, mate, this is the last time I'm going to make the effort, and if you want, you know, if you want to have a relationship with me, you can, but you've got to do the thing. But I'm the kid, you know, I'm your dad, and if you want to do something, you're going to have to do it and just reach out. And then I didn't hear from him again after I sent him that.
Gosh, you're so young and going through those experiences, and with a parent who, you know, they're our attachment figure, and when we're young, we need them and we can't help but love them. And I can't imagine the contrast of someone causing you so much pain. But then I know I read a letter that your dad had written to you, I think on your 12th birthday, that was quite profound and loving and wise. And I guess just the trauma and the difficulty in going through that when you were so young, but realizing you have to put in a boundary at one point. And I think that's a lesson that we can learn about in a lot of relationships. And it's very, very difficult when it's a family member. But at one point, if someone is continuing to cause us emotional, physical harm, regardless of who they are, we need to cut them out. And that's a big, really big lesson you learned at a really young age. And, you know, it sounds like your whole family did.
Yeah, I had a bit of a different relationship with him than my brother and sister, who were both younger and sort of didn't have the same situation. My younger brother, who was young, he never really formed that attachment at all. I don't think he never really got the best of Mike. I did. We had really great times. He was very engaging and very good, as you sort of alluded to, clever guy, and you know, had these great insights. And you know, he was a hurt person who struggled with his own demons as well. And it's hard to reconcile that as a kid. It's kind of not really your job. But you know, Hugo, you sort of touched on it before. I've always been a bit of an old head, you know, like since I was a little kid, I've always just been like an old man, you know, and so that helps, I think, you know, that's how I've always approached the world, like an old man.
Josh, just listening to that story, and people listening would, you know, be like, oh, that is really full on. And a lot of people would understand if you went off the rails a little bit, but somehow at 18, 19, you were studying philosophy and doing carpentry apprenticeship, which to me is such a contrast. Can you tell us what protective factors do you think helped you to stay on track and be dedicated and hardworking and not play the victim of, you know, my upbringing was pretty fucked, and, you know, being angry at the world and taking that out rather than putting your energy to such good use and doing so much for others?
I think that's a great question. It's a complicated question for a lot of people as well to look at that. But for me, what I look at is that, not that I had a terrible childhood, but that there were challenging moments in my childhood that were very challenging. But I was also given so many wonderful gifts. I had very literate parents who were incredibly engaged in the educational process and really encouraged me to learn and put stuff in front of me. I went to school already able to read and was always encouraged in whatever endeavor I wanted to do. You know, we didn't have any money, but I still managed, you know, mum still managed to scrape stuff together to do like one thing a term. So if you were going to do, you know, a half of the year, you know, it was athletics, we would go in the summer and then, you know, do footy in the winter. And even though I had to, you know, maybe make my own way there and stuff, that's okay. You know, like you kind of learned to just go and get after it, and you couldn't just have, you know, you couldn't just stop because you were bored or it was early or whatever. You commit, you finish it. And so around all of those things where there were some really challenging moments, there were some really wonderful moments. I've seen what really great parenting looks like from my own parents, but also from the community that I was in, where I was really fortunate to have such great support and love from, you know, friends, families and people around and good teachers and footy coaches. And I was always felt that I have a responsibility to make the most of my aptitudes, because plenty of people don't have them, you know, and it's almost disrespectful to not make the most of it. And potentially that's one of the most disappointing things about my father, was that he was one of those people that had a lot of aptitude and never followed through on anything. He'd just half do stuff and he'd half do it really well, or he'd three quarters do it or 90% do it, and then just sort of bail out when it looked like it was going to become an expectation or something like that. And that probably put a bit of a fire under my ass to be like, if you can do it, if you can run 100 Ks, go do it. If you can do you know, uni, do it. If you can earn money and pick up a trade, do it. If you can play the drum, do it. Do it and do it as well as you possibly can do, because not everyone is fortunate enough to have the aptitude or the opportunity to even give it a crack. And if you sort of take that for granted, it's almost like a slap in the face for everyone who's unfortunate enough to not have those aptitudes and opportunities.
Yeah, it's remarkable hearing you say that, Josh, because clearly an extremely challenging upbringing and growing up with, like you said, financially, not much money, the relationship with your dad, you know, being the oldest of three, having to, you know, take on that sort of father type figure for them. And then obviously supporting your mum all at the same time when you're trying to navigate the difficult times of any teenager and young guy in his 20s. But remarkably throughout all of that, and as Izzy touched on, you've had this, you know, diverse sort of career path, which sort of more or less ended up with you founding your own sort of social enterprise called Just Be Nice Project. So it'd be interesting to now delve into a bit of what the Just Be Nice Project is. And do you think from that sort of upbringing we've just spoken about and what you've learned from a younger age, did that sort of spark your desire to eventually do good in the world and create a community like you've created?
I often tell people I've never really had like an epiphanous moment. I've always felt like this is just the kind of thing that is important to me to do and the kind of problem that I'd like to solve. And again, if you have this combination of aptitude, if you have the answers, go and do it. I think the gift of challenging times, if you can take a gift out of it, is hopefully the realization that other people have challenging times they must have. So to be able to acknowledge that it wasn't just my gumption that got me through, that it wasn't just, oh, I'm just so marvelously driven and clever and wonderful that I just did it all. I just put it on my shoulders and did it all myself. To acknowledge that I'm the product of so much opportunity and support and love, and that, you know, to just want that, to have that aspiration that everyone should be able to, you know, endure and get out the other side of challenging times with that support and opportunity and love, then it changes the way that you even approach the problem of like, why don't people get good help in the first place? And I think one of the really fundamental cultural reasons that people in countries like Australia or the US or the UK don't get great help is because we overfocus on what the individual is supposed to do to get through rather than what we can do around an individual to support them through the most challenging times they've encountered, whether they be objectively horrendous things or kind of like subjectively you go, that doesn't seem like a big deal, but a tiny deal can be life altering for someone if they just happen to be at the wrong time, wrong moment, and not have that, you know, environment around them and that support to get them through and that sort of generalized exposure to challenges along the way. So, you know, there wasn't an epiphany, but, you know, here we are. Just this is the end result of a lot of work.
Josh, there's so many interesting concepts I would love to dig in deeper, but I know we're limited in this podcast, but I'm just going to quickly raise a few. I think that you talked about your own individual aptitude, and I think that's a really important concept because we put a lot of onus on an individual's hard work to have got them where they are. You know, Izzy, you're a doctor. Well done to you. You've studied so hard. In reality, both my parents were tertiary educated. I had an amazing community. I lived in the country and all of our neighbors, all of the pickers, all of my grandparents were always championing me. And I had an amazing support network and I'm naturally, you know, really brainy. And I really think sometimes in society, we put far too much onus on a person's hard work that's got them into that situation. Adversely, someone who gets themselves into a totally shit situation in life, and it doesn't even just need to be the homeless man you see on the street, you know, other people that are, you know, having struggles, so many things are out of people's control. And I see this in medicine. You know, we never blame the person for getting leukemia, but somehow we blame the person for becoming an alcoholic. And I just really think this is an important concept, especially in the social enterprise system that is supporting other people and recognizing that people can make shit decisions. And that doesn't mean they don't deserve help. They don't deserve support because of all the things that have led to that shit decision are often completely out of their hands.
You make a great point. And I think that the acknowledgement of the environment that supported people into outcomes is something we do really poorly. It's something I spend a lot of time trying to teach kids and trying to help people identify, you know, identifying things around you and not taking responsibility for everything that you've done or had success in. And that's a difficult conversation. The question I like to ask people is, can you tell the story of your life where you take no credit for anything that happened? You've got to assign it to the things you were around you and the people that were around you and the opportunities that you were given and take no credit for it yourself. And most people can't do it because they've never considered that in their life. When I grew up, there was a footy club. It was two blocks away. And because we got three, had three kids, mum had to drive my brother to basketball all the time. He's the littlest, and my sister to dancing and all this stuff. I was fortunate by virtue of genetics that I was a big kid and it was close and I could just walk to footy training. I was old enough to do it. That footy club doesn't exist anymore. So if I grew up in that same house now with the same situation, there's no club within walking distance I could just go and walk to footy. And footy made a huge difference to me. It's got nothing to do with me that footy club was two blocks away, but it was enormously impactful. So to ignore the opportunities that having amenity nearby for someone, it doesn't even sound like it's the kind of thing that turns you into, you know, someone with doing what I'm doing later on. But without it, I don't know what would have happened. You know, anything could have happened.
That's an intriguing one, Josh. I love that question. Can you tell a story of your life and take no credit for what happened? And I think that's, even now I'm just sort of going through my head thinking about some personal examples and you're spot on. I've never really thought about it that way. But it's probably a good opportunity to now ask you about the Just Be Nice project. So what is the Just Be Nice project? Tell us all about it, mate.
So the Just Be Nice project is about creating an ecosystem where you meet people where they are and give them what they need and work with them through a series of interventions and assistance and human help and logistics, material support, until they're housed, employed, and they have good mental health, or at least mental health unaffected by things like addiction or, you know, chronic anxiety or depression or whatever those like prevailing ailments is. It's not that you need to be buzzing and super happy all the time. That's not the kind of definition of good mental health that we're after. It's that you have a capacity to navigate good and tough times without them slamming you into the ground at any point in time, and you can function at work and in the community and you can be engaged. And we do that basically by having people, individuals and organizations go, we want to do good and we don't know what to do. The situation at the moment for most people wanting to do good, Hugo goes, I want to do good, what's the best charity? And then he picks one. You know, and Hugo doesn't have like much experience in the space. There's like hundreds of thousands to choose from, quite literally. And he's a guy who cares about stuff and wants to make a decision, or a business that's got to make a decision and whatever. But it's kind of like if you went to build a house and you just said, who's the best trade? And you lined them all up and you gave all your money to the plumber. Well, the plumber could deliver all the plumbing that was on the plan and get 5-star rating by any charitable rating organization as they exist currently. They did all the things they said they were going to do, whatever. Their overheads are low, blah, 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 blah. But all you've got is a pile of plumbing. You don't build houses like that because you get a builder in to coordinate the whole thing across all the different people. Well, that's what we do.
Just for anyone who is listening and has wanted to put some of their skills to good use, help, are fortunate enough to realize they have a responsibility to help others. Do you have any specific advice for them? I know once I heard you say closing conversations is closing communities, and I really like that. And I think for people listening who might think, oh, well, I don't have any skills, or, you know, I work in XYZ, so I can't do anything. Like, what advice would you have? What conversation would you have with them?
First of all, there's always something you can do. Everyone has useful skills. They don't always have a useful outlet for them, but there is always something you can do. I think community stops where conversation ends, because it just ends any kind of development, any kind of relationship building, and also any opportunity for understanding. And understanding needs of people is incredibly important if you want to be effective at helping them. And you can't do that if you constantly just want to prescribe the thing that you love. You see it on the internet all the time. PTs will tell you, oh, fitness is the answer. And then, you know, nutritionists say food's the answer. And then someone who does yoga will say meditation and yoga is the answer. And a psychologist say you need to talk to people. And a psychiatrist say we'll medicate you out. And everyone, like, everything looks like
a... Doctor, is he saying you just have to start running?
Just have to run, you know. It's like everything looks like a nail to a hammer, and people love to prescribe the thing that works for them. But the reality is you need to be better at understanding what people need, not just the thing that you like. And that takes time. So I tell people, and it sounds so trite, help the people near you until they're better. like, just try and hang in there. See how difficult it is. See how many things they need, how many things they're missing. Give yourself like time. Have patience. Don't go 100% of your energy in for 6 weeks and then bail out. Go 50% of your energy and hang in there for the long term, because most people have complex needs that are incredibly difficult to meet. Until you understand that, you're going to be very ineffective at helping others anyway. And one of the huge barriers to good help is trust. And if you've already got trust with the people you're close to, you're halfway there, 90% of the way there. So help the people close to you, make sure they're okay. If you don't think anyone near you needs a hand, you don't know enough people well enough, get to know them better, you know? And in that space, get comfortable with talking about poo and periods and wee and good times and bad times and feeling shitty and being happy and being sad and being jealous and, you know, being stressed by money and feeling fat and not being able to get off the couch and do something and being motivated and being demotivated. Have those conversations. Work with people. Don't demand that they just get up and do what you tell them to do straight away. And once you've done that for a while, you'll start to get the hang of like, okay, this help thing is challenging and there's a lot of areas of expertise that we need more help in. And then you're probably much better at helping at that point, which is why I think kids and people from challenging communities that do have their, you know, opportunities and do develop skills are so much better in this space than people who come from sort of resource rich, challenge poor environments that then decide they want to help people. They've never been in it with people that need help like that. And they've poorly set up to go and dig in for the long haul and what is a challenging and long journey for many.
So in a bit of a summary there, Josh, you're saying that helping people takes time. You know, helping people is challenging. Now, I find personally, I can often take things on. So if I've got, say, a family member or a friend going through a difficult time, I sort of invest too much energy and time into that I think it's almost detrimental for my own health, if that makes sense. So whether it be, yeah, someone really close to my family going through a really stressful time, and I'll be messaging them, taking calls, almost acting a bit like a counselor, which I'm not trained or qualified for. I want to try and help them do everything I can, but in a way it can be pretty draining for myself as well. So at what stage do you kind of have to take a step back and almost the referral process of, you know, there are professionals out here that can help you through these things?
That's a really great question, mate. And I think that, again, it speaks to the importance of having those attempts to find those sort of limits. You've got to keep your cup full enough to help others, and you've got to be able to meter your engagement in help that way. You know, you can't go 100% into your cousin who's got complex long-term psychiatric and addiction problems, and you're going to burn out. And people burn out all the time. The overwhelming majority of people who try and help someone close to them burn out. I think it's a symptom of the shitty messaging from charities about helping people. It's incredibly transactional. They keep telling you all you got to do is this and it changes someone's life. They share countless stories about how, oh, I just did this one thing and it changed this guy's life forever, turned their life around. That's all you hear. No one says, I picked up this guy, Hugo, who's an old mate of mine. 15 years later, he's finally off drugs. He's finally got his psychiatric care under control. He's finally living independently and he's doing good. For 15 years, he's been a wonderful dude who's been very difficult to deal with for a lot of people on and off, but I love him and I've been there for him in a way that didn't burn me out. But when he needed me, it was great. When he crossed the boundary, I told him, I love you, but you've crossed the boundary and I need a minute. And no one ever talks about it. It's already too boring. That's already too long for an ad, you know? And the gratification is so delayed, you can't raise money like that. So in the process of doing that, and you go, you've done it a few times, for instance, you say, okay, I'm starting to get a feel for where my limits are so that I can better do a job for this person or these people today or later on or whatever. You will make mistakes. That's part of the deal. You're gonna have some people you burn out on and they're gonna move on, and that's okay too, just like any relationship. But you've got to be conscious of it. And I think making sure your cup's full is important. Not like, doesn't have to be full all the time, like, but making sure you don't burn out on it. And that's why it's important to tell people, guys, helping people takes ages. It takes ages. If you're advocating for 2-week programs, 1-day programs, 6-day programs, you're advocating for the wrong stuff. We need 10-year programs, 10-year development, 10 years of assistance. We need to guarantee assistance for people until they're better, not until the clock says we've run out of funding, everyone's tired, you haven't got there, you're on your own. And part of that starts with the way that we look at how we help people that need help around us, and making sure that we have enough internal resources to be there for the long term. And sometimes that means saying, mate, I love you, but I need a minute. You know, I'm here if you really need it, but it's too much. I'm knackered and I need to do some other stuff or whatever, and be comfortable again with that level of honesty in that conversation.
Josh, that is just really great advice. And I don't think I've seen it framed in that way. And I know I'm personally identifying. I supported a friend through a drug addiction a few years ago. And I think if I had have had someone say that to me then, of this will take time, you're not going to be able to fix them in a month, that would have been really grateful for me. Because I, you know, if I've got a lot of cold sores now, I think I had a hell of a lot more back then because I was so bloody stressed. You guys can't see, but my whole face is pretty much one cold sore at the moment. And I also just think, as we talk about a long time for things to get better, I think we need to think about that with cultures and attitudes as well, because a lot of reasons for social disadvantage, for poor mental health, are to do with deeply ingrained cultures. And that's not going to change overnight. And if you are in the space of trying to change things and improve things, not being too hard on yourself when we don't see instant results, because we can't have, you know, intergenerational trauma and disadvantage change overnight. And I think that's, you know, similar for poor mental health as well, of, you know, what are the things that have led to someone feeling like they can't share how they're feeling, they can't get professional help. They're not going to change in a second. So being patient with yourself and with the people you're trying to help.
It's a really important process. And Hugo, I know you've had your experiences with cancer, for instance, and I certainly wouldn't wish it on anybody, but you can have a moment of cancer, you get a diagnosis, you get treated, and then you can have, you know, you can be in remission for a while and then you can get it again. And you could post, I'm going back to chemo 2 years, 5 years later. And people would be like, mate, so brave. You're so brave. You're so strong. If I said I relapsed and I had to go back to rehab because I'm relapsing, I'm having heroin again, people call you completely different names. They treat you very, very differently. If you say, I don't have a job yet, and it's, you know, I've been 6 weeks on the dole or been looking for a job and tried a few things, people say, what's wrong with you? Get on with it. Hurry up. And I work with people where if you told their stories as an eight-year-old, people would be crying themselves in the streets, falling over themselves to try and like spectacularly throw money at them or help them. Oh my God, this poor eight-year-old. Well, newsflash, that eight-year-old becomes an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old, and they're not just better because they're 20 now. And if they didn't get that help, and then it takes them a while to get a job, I sit there and I applaud these people for getting out of bed after the stuff they've been through. I don't even know how they function. I don't know how they have friends. I don't know how they leave the house. And they're out there struggling maybe to get work or hold work down. And we just treat them so differently to people and we resource it differently. Peter Mac would take me 100 times in my lifetime if I needed it. And no one would say anything except, geez, that's a bit of bad luck. But if you want to engage in social services, some places literally will only take you once. And once you've done that one time, you're not allocated another dollar of funding or opportunity after that, because it's like, well, if you weren't sorted in this 6 weeks, well, you're on your own. And I just think that's abhorrent. And we need to change the way that we talk about that and treat those opportunities and treat those people, because as your friend, when you've got cancer, I'm fully aware that my role is to sit next to you and hold your hand and say, bro, this sucks. I'm so sorry. I love you so much. I'm right here. You know, you have a nap on my shoulder. Do what you got to do. But if I'm your friend and you're having drug addiction problems or you can't get work, somehow it's my job to find you work, keep you in training, get you some stuff, get you off drugs, communicate with the rehab center, do all of these things. And it's just grossly unfair for a lay person to have to do it in this circumstance, challenged by these sorts of problems, where we have this other example of like, actually, if you just let the right experts come in and do it in the right time, in a well-resourced environment with no end except Hugo needs to get better, then we know that's an effective system. And we know that it's a much better system to be the human support for Hugo in, if you're just a lay person who's there to be like, mate, this sucks. Can I get you an ice block? That's what we try to do. You know, that's what my whole MO is in life, is to change that system for all of those other kinds of challenges.
It's really powerful the way you can communicate those messages. And I'm going to put my hand up and admit the fact that I probably haven't thought about it in that way before, or as deeply as that. But when you said an eight-year-old will also become that 20-year-old, 30-year-old, when you see that person going to, you know, suffering from addiction, going back to drug rehab, someone who's unemployed, struggling to find jobs, etc. There's often so much that goes behind the scenes, and you have no idea what that person's potentially gone through from as a young kid right up through their difficult teenage years. So, no, I really, really appreciate, Josh, sort of you, the way you articulated that was really good. And we've talked a couple of times about community in this chat, and I think it's a big one. And you more than anyone, Josh, being in Victoria, or your fellow Victorians, community has been massive in the last 18 months, 2 years. How have you personally coped with the lockdowns, the Melbourne being the most locked down city in the world? How have you personally coped? I understand you had to close your gym, you've had your own challenges, but also the sense of community amongst Victorians. How have you personally observed that from your lens?
Yeah, look, it's been a long time. I've sort of had this chat where I was like, I wonder if they told me it was going to be basically 2 years of lockdown at the beginning of 2020, if I would have done things differently. You know, like if I knew it was going to be 2 years, because I think a huge part of the challenge was the preparing to come out and then going back in, and the preparing to come out and then going back in, and then getting a bit gun shy about it, and then not having like certainty about how long we were going to be locked down and all those sorts of things. But one important sort of focus for me has always been to share your calm, not your chaos, through all of this. And I think that the majority of people have been just trying to look after each other in the best possible way they can do, and kind of make those adjustments. And so for me, I've just tried to carry myself in a way that I can hopefully reflect on in a few years' time and go, I'm pretty happy and proud of how I carried myself through the pandemic, not losing my mind too much, trying to bring people together and along. And most people, I think, have been leaning on each other in a way that is helpful.
I'm going to personally identify what a voice of reason you were, and how much your PSAs, what is it? Like, what does PSA stand for?
Public service announcement.
Your public service announcements and your reels actually personally really helped me. And I think they really explained, one, how much like rage does not help anyone. And rage and anger sometimes is a normal, and I work as a doctor and I see terrible things happen to good people for no reason. And I think the pandemic is a little bit like this. It's been this really shit thing that none of us did to deserve, but we're all enduring. And the different ways of handling that situation, you know, you can be angry and you can rage, and maybe that gives some people a sense of control, or, you know, that they're fighting back to this unfortunate situation, or you can act with hope and calm. And I think you really exemplifying that helped me and made me aware of someone who has a small platform, but a little bit of a platform, of the importance of hope and positivity when the situation isn't going to be changed depending on your reaction. And not only did that maybe help some of the people that follow my page and I interact with, but it helped me a lot as well. And, you know, I think it's pretty impressive, Josh, you lost your business, one of the businesses, the gym, and your Just Be Nice has also been impacted. You've been in the longest lockdown, and a lot of people would understand if you were that rage, angry person, but instead, yeah, you've been such a voice of reason for so many people. And yeah, thank you for that.
I must admit, I wish I started following you earlier, because when I came across you through Izzy, some of your videos, you watch them and you go, ah, that makes sense.
You feel just lighter.
You feel better. You have these ways of articulating it. So first of all, for those listening, I highly recommend you go follow Josh Reed Jones on Instagram, because he does have these really insightful educational videos, but it's also two of my personal faves as well, which is a bit more lighthearted. I really liked your makeup tutorial that you did.
Yeah, that was a bit of a disaster.
Because I was scrolling through last night looking at a couple, and then the one of you in your robe and your guitar singing in the shower during lockdown. That's a good one.
Yeah, Josh might come across as this kind of serious person, but if you look at his Instagram, there's him like doing this very kind of hip belly dancing type, you know, and the shower singing. It's you've brought a lot of light to a lot of people in a tough time.
Oh, thank you.
So just the back end question of that sort of lockdown community, before we do sort of start to finish things up, you know, what is probably the biggest lesson or biggest lessons, a positive lesson from what we've gone through?
Yeah, I've been reflecting on this a bit lately, and I feel like, you know, in my notebooks now, just writing away, because it's been difficult to articulate. It's been really difficult to articulate the intersection of support, but also accountability and, you know, doing things for one another and all this sort of stuff. And I mean, I spent my whole life playing team sports. Hughes, you're in the army, you understand what goes on. Being a good teammate, I think, is what's really important. And a good teammate doesn't mean you never call out your mates for being dickhead teammates. A good teammate, you know, knuckles down when it's their turn to go. A good teammate can be fun and irreverent, but serious. A good teammate is encouraging. A good teammate holds people accountable. A good teammate makes people better. A good teammate does things for the benefit of the team. A good teammate doesn't overly focus on themselves. I think that I couldn't think of a better way to articulate it than you want to be a good teammate for everyone through this time. And it means you've got an opportunity to still go, I don't agree with that. I don't think that's good. Because people love to hop on and go, oh, you said that and that's not nice. They go, mate, let me tell you something. Being nice is not never holding people accountable. It's not having a position. It's not saying you don't disagree with anybody or anything like that. But being nice is about being the best possible teammate you can be for the widest, broadest possible team. And I think that generally speaking, in Victoria and in Melbourne, people have been great teammates. People have been getting it done and they've been getting it done for each other. And I appreciate that. And I think it's incredibly positive to see that happening. And I think that's something really positive to take away from the last sort of 18, 20 months.
I think we can apply that to so many situations as well. We can apply it to our work. We can apply it to our family. We can apply it to our friendship circles. And I think sometimes the people closest to us we forget almost those important values of being nice, being kind, being understanding, and applying those principles at home are so important. If we can't apply them at home, you know, what's the point? And now we're going to start to wrap up, Josh, but I want you to quickly tell us what's next for Just Be Nice. And if people want to find out more, if there's any way they could get involved, how that could be.
Yeah, great. Look, it's for us, it's just about expanding our possibilities, you know, resource allocation and getting out to more people, more places and doing more work and integrating across, you know, having better things to give people and more opportunities to help. If people want to get involved, you can just go to jbnproject.com, obviously N for nice. And there's like little things. If you want to do something, you can put your hand up. If you've got a business that's interested, you know, do those things. We do training and workshops, and I'm pretty accessible kind of person. So, you know, you can just reach out and we'll, you know, we'll start from wherever you are and see what we can do. But again, it's like patience too. There's a patience element. Sometimes we can't do stuff right away, and it's good to know you want to do stuff. It might take a minute, but, you know, we'll get there eventually. There's plenty of people who need help. So,
no, it's inspiring to hear all the work you're doing, you know, not only in the personal setting, but with the Just Be Nice project. It's an amazing project, and I'd hate to think how many people you've truly helped over the years. But before we ask the final closing questions, I just want to ask, are you 100% happy, Josh, all the time? I feel like you strike me as the type of guy that's never had road rage or, you know, never bloody sworn when your team misses a goal.
Mate, I swear like a trooper and I rage with the best of them. You know, my offline raging is stuff of legend. But I think it's important not to try. I don't try and swallow my rage and just turn it into something great straight away, but I do it. I rage and I see what has caused the rage by just letting it come out. Oh, this is so dumb. This is bloody, I'm so frustrated, whatever. And I do that. Definitely not happy all the time. I get angry. I get frustrated. I get sad. But I also just don't think it's productive to have conversations like that. I try and foster, I suppose, a public conversation that allows as many people to participate as possible. And so I think it's important to, you know, get the rage off your chest, see what's bothering you, work out what you can do about that, and then approach it in the most productive way and take it from there. So look, I get road rage, but my I've got a van, says Just Be Nice all over it. I can't really get out and yell at people.
Not very good marketing.
I'm constantly reminded that, you know, it's part of what I've got to do.
Me being a doctor, having a cigarette out the front of the hospital.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And people do it and I have my moments, but they haunt me. And you know, as I get older, I have less of those moments because I just think, I don't want to be that guy. You know, who the best version of me wouldn't have just done that thing. So bugger. Now I've got to, you know, I don't want to do that. And I try really hard to do that. It's a process, but you know, of course I still get angry. I still swear. I still call people all kinds of things under the sun when I'm at home or on the phone. So,
well, it's kind of a nice little segue to the final question we like to actually ask our guest, and maybe something that you can leave, you know, your words of wisdom for our listeners. And we call it a bit of the mental health or sort of well-being challenge, whereby you can set Izzy and me something which we'll then go away and try and do it for the next week. And the plan is that when we release this, the listeners listening to it right now can also hopefully go away and try to do this challenge. So what can you leave us on, Josh? And what's your little challenge for the week for us?
My challenge would be to check in with people close to you and see how they're doing. And I probably have an auxiliary challenge to that, which is to do some things for some people and don't tell anybody.
I mopped the floor this morning. Does that count?
Yeah.
I think I told my boyfriend, I was like, look, I'm actually doing some cleaning. Please tell me how great I am.
But you just do some stuff. It doesn't mean you don't have to tell the person that you're helping, but like, don't tell anybody else, you know, like don't tell anyone you did a thing.
Do good.
And then just try and sit on it. I think it's interesting to see sometimes how difficult it is. The urge to tell people you did a thing it can be pretty strong, you know? So
thank you so much, Josh. It's been really great having you on, not just for your business, but also just all of the wisdom that you can pass on it. And also just the inspiration that you've done heaps, but you've had a team of people that have got you there. And I think we can apply that to lots of lessons in life. And
no, thank you. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. And don't worry, if I had arms like the commando, I would have had them out the whole time as well. But, you know, we've got to play to our strengths, you know, when we're hanging out with people. So I appreciate the opportunity very much.
Love it, Josh. Thanks, mate. Appreciate it.